So good evening. It's with a pleasure and a privilege to be here. I was given a sense of Mission Impossible. I was told to give a half an hour shiur. I traveled so far and so long to make it here. The shiur has to be obviously significant and not a run-of-the-mill shiur. On the other hand, half an hour is it's called a chati shiur. Chati shiur, asur min haTorah. Therefore, my solution will be to try to make a schematic presentation. In other words, I will not try to prove things rigorously from A to Z. For that, I have to come to Eretz Yisrael, to Gush Etzion, to hear me there. But I will try to take a topic and try to present schematically and to make a more broad and general claim, which I believe can be proved or at least can be established. But I will give the main outlines this evening. Secondly, this shiur will try to touch on the boundary, or if you want, the interplay between halacha and machshava. The Rav wrote at the end of halachic mind, at the worldview of halacha, a new philosophy will arise. First, my filler of Hutner did more of it in Pachad Yitzchak than the Rav himself did in his writings. But the basic idea to take halachic data and to create a philosophical worldview, something my father has done on various occasions. I would like tonight to turn the tables and to take rather a philosophical or ashkavic approach and to try to insert it into halachic data. No, it's not to use halacha to create a machshava, but to use the machshava to create some of the halacha. And I chose a topic which would seem to be a very yeshivish, legal oriented and should scare you off, but I will try to once more to delve beyond the more technical elements of it to try to get to the mashgafic elements. Now we'll start with discussing relationships in halacha. However, the relationships we'll give are legal relationships. It was basically the interchange or the relationship between litigants, testifiers, and the like in the court. But then see how this goes beyond that. Of course, two other reasons both deal with halacha and the legal field, so it's to be appropriate for that as well. We all know the Torah has requirements for testimony, for edus. We need two edim, pishnayim edim yakum davar. You can see the first verse there in the sheet. Pishnayim edim u'shlosha edim yumat hamet, lo yumat api ed echad. You need two or three witnesses to give testimony before you punish anyone. Yad ha'edim debo v'rishan amito, the edim will be the first who will execute the verdict, if there's a guilty verdict in such a case. V'yad kolam b'achrona, and everyone else later on. V'yad tahara mikir becha, you remove the evil from your midst. Now, not only do you need two people, but there are various qualifications regarding these people. And there are various psui edus, or reasons which disqualify edim from witnesses from being valid. Some would seem to be self-obvious. A person who lacks the ability to judgment. We call halacha shote, person who is insane. Or a child, a baby, obviously he just can't witness, he can't testify, he can't observe properly, and so on and so forth. To others, who are disqualified for other reasons as well. Now I'd like to focus upon one particular category, namely relatives. It's called krovim. Now, it would seem to be quite clear why are they disqualified. The obvious reason that we doubt the validity of the testimony. We assume they may not be telling the truth, either consciously or subconsciously. They will simply not tell us, not give an accurate representation of what happened. So differently, we tend to assume, our starting point presumably is, that edus, testimony halacha, is an attempt to tell a story. You come to a court, there is doubtless what happened. Reuven says A, Shimon says B, they dispute exactly what happened. The best way to resolve the dispute is to have a camera in place. If you have a video cassette, it'll tell you exactly what happened. So if you have technology, you use surveillance cameras. If you have technology of 2,000 years ago, use the surveillance cameras in people's eyes, and you record the data on the hard disk within, and then you come and play it back in the court. In other words, what you're really looking for is a camera which observes the scene and provides us the data of what happened. And therefore, if the camera is smudged, for instance, their relatives, and the picture may be distorted, either positively or negatively, because, see in a moment, Sefer Chinuch claims relatives are not impartial, either they like each other or they hate each other, but they're never partial, but they're always partial to each other. So therefore, we cannot simply rely upon the testimony. Put differently, every plagueis, anyone disqualified, we will assume it's due to lack of reliability of his testimony. However, now let's see how the Gemara itself approaches the question. This is the second source here for the Gemara Sanhedrin of Chavzayim. Mina hanimili, the Tan Rabbanan, lo yumtu avot al banim. We're told that the Torah says, how do we know what's the source of disqualifying relatives? Lo yumtu avot al banim, and you cannot kill the father because of the sins of the son, and vice versa, the son because of the sins of the father. Ma tamud lomar, if the Torah has to tell us the trivial idea that you do not kill an innocent parent because the child sinned, or you don't kill this in child because the father sinned, we don't need a special pasuk for that. That should be clear to us because of plain and simple justice and morality. In the Gemara's phrases, if they tell us you don't kill the child of the parent because of the sins of the other, it's a basic principle that you kill a person only for his own transgressions, not for those of his relatives. So therefore, you have to reinterpret the phrase, you will not kill fathers based upon the testimony of children, and you will not kill children based upon the testimony of their fathers. And I'm skipping here a little, and going three lines to the bottom. Ask this tells us that you shouldn't punish parents or children because of the testimony of their relatives. How do we know? Not only do you not punish them, but the reverse, that you're going to acquit them because of the testimony, that you cannot acquit them. I'm not clear. So we have the pasuk has a redundancy, and therefore you can, because the second phrase, you can learn not only negatively, positively as well. Okay, the word continues. Now, I'll get back to this in a moment. After you have the source, let's look what Chazal tell us about the reason, the rationale. This is the next source in the sheet. Towards the end, the second half. When it says as follows, even though we trust and believe the actual Edim, we believe the testimony. The proof is, I'm reading here three lines from the bottom of the third source. Zirat Melechi, the Rav Yishunim Shaker, not because he's giving us false testimony, what he's saying is true. If you don't think so, Moshe the Aaron the Chotanam should go Mehemi. If Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen would come and give testimony to a common relative, would we not trust them? Of course we would. So what is it? Xeris Melech. In other words, it's an arbitrary divine decree, or it's a divine decree, which disqualifies them regardless of the level of reliability of the agents. Even though we trust them, nevertheless, they're disqualified. Just Melechi. In other words, we disqualify them not because they have problems of reliability, but because the Torah decreed they're disqualified. Because Rambam decided, and that's that. Rambam here goes to the next source. Rambam records this as part of Mishnah Torah. Zeh shepasak chai yudak krovin, the reason the Torah disqualified relatives, not because we don't trust them, because they love each other. The proof that Rambam says is the fact that he's disqualified not only to help his relative, but also to testify against him. Presumably, we suspect, we're suspicious of the relative when he's trying to help his relative, not when he's trying to injure him. We see that Rav Sefer Chinuch says not always true. Times relatives try often to harm each other. But the Rambam at least is using this idea of lechova, in other words, the fact that he disqualified even to testify against his relative as proof that it's nothing to do with his reliability. It has to do with the fact that the Torah decreed unilaterally that he's disqualified. Not because we think that they love each other. The proof is he hasn't testified either way. It's an arbitrary decree. Therefore, a person who's actually a friend or an enemy, even though people who we really don't trust can somehow deal with their testimony. It's only those are relatives. So really we have here a need to understand what's the exact melech. Okay, I can solve my problem. Jezakasuv. And if I were a Brister, I would say like that. That Jezakasuv, the Torah decreed, and of course, if you come, there's a philosophy behind this. Your philosophy is that you do mitzvot only out of awe, only because you're subordinate to Kadosh Baruch Hu. So you can't improve like that. Why? I don't know. When my kid says to me, why should I go to bed on time? So I say, Lama Kacha. In other words, you do it because you do it, and that's the end of that. However, if I want something beyond that, we have to try and understand what is the idea of Anijat Melech. Because I assume, as the Rambam did, because Baruch is not arbitrary, because Baruch has good reasons for his decisions, reasons also which we can try to fathom in some level or another, that basically rationalism means that we believe not only it's a reason, but also it's a reason that's accessible to us, and therefore we should seek a reason. Secondly, I have a bigger problem here. I could get along with the fact that we say Gzirat Melech. And here I could do, I won't focus on because of time constraints, reading Sefer Chinuch later on. Sefer Chinuch says, indeed the Torah disqualified them because they're not trustworthy. So why do you disqualify even when they are testifying against? It's basically to condemn them. The answer is because the Torah did not want to begin to make distinctions. It made a blanket statement, it disqualified them totally, and did not want to begin to have some kind of distinctions. However, if you go back to the source we had before, and this I think is a crucial point, the Gemara says as follows, and this is back in the second source, three lines to the bottom. Ashkechal lechovah lizchut minalan. We know from the source, and I have to remind you, the source that disqualifies relatives is volume 2 about the Bani. In other words, the Torah doesn't begin by saying that don't trust the relatives, they'll try to help their cousins, their fathers, their children. It begins by reverse. Don't let them condemn their offspring or their parents. In other words, the Torah is not concerned so much with letting a relative allow his relative to get away with it. Rather, they're concerned the opposite. They're concerned with having one relative condemn another. Now, presumably, this is the reverse. Intuitively, would have said, Ashkechal lizchut, I understand why he disqualified to help him. Lichobat, to harm, minalan. The one thing is the opposite. That the fact that you can't harm them, that's self-evident. The fact you can't help, that's less evident. Presumably, the reverse of what we'd assume. So therefore, it's clear the Gemara doesn't believe the problem is the reliability or that he's helping him. Rather, something else here. And I'll state the basic idea and I'll try to illustrate a few other halachot. Essentially, the Gemara thinks the following. A dude is not a camera. It's not an object trying to record events. Heck, up at the point. So A, either we would have disqualified and you can't trust them, or we would have put safeguards to ensure you can trust them. The problem here is not the, as I said before, smudge on the camera, that we can't trust the camera. And basically, a dude is not an attempt to record events. It's rather we expect the person to be involved with the subject. We expect the aid, in which we want it to not be a legal relationship, not to be an observer relationship, we want to be a participant. Essentially, an aid is a participant in a drama. This is the drama of the event, whatever the case happens to be. And the aid is not simply someone observing something. Rather, he is a participant. And to put it differently, it's not a legal issue, it's not a historical issue, it's an interpersonal relationship. There's an interpersonal element between the edim and the person, and the Baal Dabar, the person who they're testifying against, and as such, if we treat the edim. And now, the reason the Torah doesn't want edim to testify against their relatives, the Torah feels that it's morally wrong for someone to implicate his relatives in a crime, in a sin, to condemn him, because, as before, it's basically a value judgment, it's almost an accusation. Look at the pasuk I quoted at the beginning. Yad ha'idim tebo barishona lamito. The edim are not impartial observers who disappear, provide information, and disappear. The edim are the ones who are expected to execute the punishment. Yad ha'idim tebo barishona. And the reason is because they're participants. You see a crime, you hear someone blasphemy, you see murder, you don't walk away and just provide information to the police. You're offended. You are a participant in the event. The event itself affects you. Yad ha'idim tebo barishona. They are expected to take a part in this. And therefore, the Torah thought that the complicated part of the relatives is not so much the reliability, it's rather, it thought it was wrong for a child to condemn and to judge a parent, even if he's worthy of condemnation. And in reverse, that the parent should not condemn a child. We of course know that we have one such case, it's called Ben Sorer Moreh, which requires a whole separate share, a whole separate discussion, but we also know Chazal basically neutralized Ben Sorer Moreh, because indeed we see it an existential problem we're having crossing the lines between parent, child, accuser, and accused. We want to keep these lines separate. The edim are accusers, and parents and children should not accuse each other. Therefore, it's easier for the girl to understand that it's improper for a parent or a child to accuse or condemn their parent or child. That is clear, that is a problem. She's not condemned, she's acquitted. There, it should be a problem. There is nothing metaphysically wrong. I mean, we see the edim and the parent, we see the relatives as one metaphysical entity. We see them as existentially one and the same, they're the same unit. People that cannot accuse or condemn each other. But the Torah, the Chazal, at a certain stage in the argument, are questioning, maybe there's nothing wrong with acquitting them. We exclude me now, and that may be alright. The response is even that is even that is wrong, because we see the edim, basically relatives are seen here as one entity. It's not a question of it's wrong to accuse. If they're one entity, they are roles as the edim are participants, but they're roles. There's the role of the edim, there's the role of the Baal Dabar, in other words, there's the role of being accused, there's the role of the testifying, and you cannot cross roles. So therefore, he's scooter also. Now, all this makes a lot of sense in the Nefashot. When you have capital crime, it's much less evident in cases of Dinei Mamonot, in the case in which it's a monetary dispute. In fact, the next line in the second source, the final line, after Dinei Nefashot, Dinei Mamonot Minalad, we know that this is the case in Dinei Nefashot, it's far from clear that Dinei Mamonot is the same thing. Maybe monetary disputes, they would not be disqualified, but you could use them. The answer is Mishpat Yechad Yelachem. Now, what exactly is the solution here I leave open at the moment? It may be that's a dual problem, namely both the problem mentioned before of having of the A's participant, he cannot participate against his parents. And the second problem of reliability, it may be even monetary elements, we see a relationship. And the monetary dispute is not only a dispute which is similar for money, it's always about relationships. I think it's true in life in general, when people fight about money, it's usually relationships. I sat just this week with a couple getting divorced, and the fight about the money is not to do with the money, it has to do with the relationships, and therefore we don't want relatives involved in these relationships as well. Now, to the same paradigm presented here can be presented in many, many other Hilchot Eidut. I'll just mention briefly one or two and then move on to summarize to one other area. I'll take just two other such cases, but before that, I'd like to make a suggestion. I haven't found it in written any place. Then again, I didn't do great research for half an hour share. But I'll say the following. If you look at the Rambam, Sefer Mitzvahs, if you look at Sefer Chinuch, they all say that it's recorded as a mitzvah. As such, they say that you cannot... the testimony of a relative is disqualified. But I would like to suggest, not only is it disqualified, if Beis Din should act upon it, the Beis Din is an error. They acted upon it for every reason. They're also over a lot. They're violating a mitzvah. So of course, if it's disqualified, you won't be acting upon it. For every reason, a Beis Din will go ahead and accept the aid of a relative, or be a secular court or whatever, that there was a court which is not using halachic rules. Nevertheless, to use the testimony of a karov, at least in the end of Hashat, at the very least, will also be an isur lo taaseh, because the problem is not simply the validity or the trustworthiness of the testimony. It's rather something wrong in having it be done, and therefore you'll be over an isur lo taaseh as well. Now, take two other quick examples. We have a famous machloket whether a person who's not observant he violates knowingly and willingly mitzvot. He's a mumah. So you have here machloket by the Rava. Rava says a mumah is special agus. A mumah is not disqualified. Why? A mumah who you suspect is not telling the truth. In other words, you know that he's dishonest in monetary matters, you disqualify. But a mumar who has integrity, he has issues of Kadosh Baruch Hu, the other one, makom, he's violation, he doesn't eat kosher, but he observes all. He is scrupulous in his dealings, Brother Machaveiro. So Rabbi says, it's kosher la'edus, because I have no reason to suspect he's not telling the truth. In other words, the only yardstick is that of reliability. But Abai says it's possible. Why? Because it says, Al Tashet Yedcha Mashal Yod Eidcha Mas. Abai reads the pasuk as follows. Al Tashet Yedcha colon, A Yimasha, B Yod Eidcha Mas. It's a common construction in the rest of Chazal. And you take a pasuk which reads in a straight line and you divide it with a colon into A and B. Lo yuchal b'alav rishon l'shuv l'kachta achre sheru tama is the classic paradigm of this. Lo yuchal b'alav rishon colon A l'shuv l'kachta, you cannot return your wife after she's been divorced and remarried. B achre sheru tama is Yisra Resota who's married. In other words, you take the pasuk and read it not as in one line, as in two lines. So here to Abayit says, Al tashet yadcha A im rasha, B yad yadcha mas. What's about rasha? The problem is not with the reliability. Abai is not disputing Rava's claim about that. Rather, Abai says that to be an aid, you need a certain personal status. So for the aid is a participant here, the aid is not simply a camera. He's a personal participant. And we have our rules, who we allow to participate. It's part of belonging to the group, to the community. You have to be achicha b'mitzvot. And if not, you are existentially not part of the group, and if you can't testify. What's more important for us is the fact that Torah disqualifies Kutumas Rishonim Eidus, which is written. You cannot send written testimony. Why? There's no participation of the subject to subject. You don't look at the person you're choosing the eye. There's no eye there. It's simply information. Written information is probably better than oral information. It's recorded, you can't deny it, it's here for the record, it's on the record, so to speak. But the problem is, you are not participating as a participant. You have to be there in person to have an eye-to-eye relationship with the person you're accusing. Therefore, the mitzvah is a makos, and you can look up later on the sources. If a person appears in Beis Din, he has trouble talking, he's hoarse or whatever, and he asks for pen and paper, and presents the pen and paper in person, it's kosher. And it makes perfect sense. The problem is not the technical problem with your speaking or writing. The problem, rather, is, are you participating as a subject or not? If you participate as a subject, even if you are there, you know, so if you're there in person, it's kosher. And if you are sending, if you're in video conferencing, I have my doubts. You need a personal interaction in order to be kosher. Here's what I would quote. There's one opinion which is eminently reasonable, that this is so in Dinei Nefashot, but not Dinei Mamonot. Dinei Mamonot really is information. Dinei Nefashot really is participation, which would require a longer discussion. Now, conclusion. I'd like to conclusion now to 20 seconds deal with one other topic. Just before that, I should also mention, there's a Chazal Rishonim about the halacha is that when Beis Din arrives at conclusion, the Balei Din, you know, the people who come to court and are either being accused or are disputing with each other, you know, the litigants have to stand. The Balei Yeshiva, Balei Din Bamida. Do they have to stand when the Eidim give the testimony? It's the Chazal Rishonim. Tells us in Sahed and Shavuos have different conclusions. What's the idea of having to stand when someone's been made? It means to be accused. In other words, it means it's not information. If Eidim is information, so there's no to stand then. When the Beis Din will arrive at a verdict, you have to stand. But not when someone's providing information. Not only the Eidim is providing information. If you assume the Balei Din have to stand when the Eidim are providing information, it's not information. You know, it's an accusation. There's something going on there between them. There's a relationship, and for that, because they're the position of those who are accused, so they have to stand. And the same is true, of course, halacha. You cannot have a verdict when the person is not present. So the mother of a comment has a discussion. Never a person, an animal. If you're condemning an animal, as long as the Yaakov and Chan Tama Tama. Rabbi Yaakov says there's no need. Why? Because love may tana. In other words, an animal can't argue. His assumption is that the need for the Baal Din to be present is to present his side. It's a question of reliability and to be able to dispute inaccuracies. So a shor is not going to do that. But Chacham say it's a different custom that you have to be there not because it's a metaphysical issue. You have to be there when you're being judged, not because you add anything to the accuracy of the testimony or the reliability of the judgment. Simply, it is the right thing. Existentially, the person being judged, you have to do it in front of the person. We don't judge people in the abstract. We judge people. People are present in court. Now, this brings us to the final point, which is there's a famous halacha called Nigo. It's a complicated halacha. I won't belabor you now with all the details. Broadly speaking, it means a person makes claim A. Claim A, we have trouble believing, but he could make claim B. If he claims A, which will make him lose the case, but he couldn't claim B. So he had a Yiddish club. So he said, I could have said B, even I said A, who cares? As long as I could have said B. That's called Nigo. Now, it's obviously very problematic. At the end of the day, he's making his final claim, which will cause him to lose. But we say it doesn't matter. As long as he could have made a claim which he could win, good enough. It bothers everyone from the age of 13 onwards to study Gemara, and the normal classic explanation is that the fact that he claims A, even though he could have claimed B, proves that he's telling the truth. And if he was out to lie, he could have lied better. In other words, it's a way of establishing the reliability of what he's saying. And what's more, it's another example of using reliability as a yardstick. In this case, not for the witness, but the person who's making the claim on his own behalf. However, these well-known proofs, some of Asman in his Sefer, deals with this at length, those proofs that show, that illustrate really, that it's not necessarily a question of reliability. Rather, the very fact that I could have won, that in and of itself allows me to win the decision, even though I'm making the wrong claim. And not because it proves that my claim is true. So it's called kwachatana. I have the ability to win. That's good. You know, if I have an ace up my sleeve, you know, I leave it up my sleeve and play a different card. Nevertheless, I win because of what I have up my sleeve. It's easy to defy logic. And of course, if you read Rabbi Chaim's piece, he just proves that it exists. He never attempts to describe the logic behind it. I think in a nutshell, the story is as follows. What we think is, we're not arguing the case. If you argue the incident, if you're trying to prove what actually happened, you can't do that. If you say it happened A, because it rained yesterday and really was sunshine, so you're not going to say you could have won since you could have said sunshine, so saying rain is good enough. No, this doesn't work. If you're trying to describe history, what could have happened is not history. If you're trying to give it to describe the incident, obviously we only follow what you describe, and therefore it doesn't work. But Christian, what we're saying is, we don't care about the incident. What really is it? We're not trying to figure out what happened. It's rather saying it's two people against each other. It's Reuven versus Shimon. It's two people who are basically the disputes between people. It's not an attempt to figure out what happened. It's not an attempt to discover whether Reuven owes Shimon money or not. It's really a battle between people, not an attempt to figure out an incident. Now, and therefore we go back and we say, now how Reuven can prove or win what he has up his sleeve is irrelevant. It's really Reuven versus Shimon. But put differently, the Niga works because we basically claim that every Din Torah is not an attempt to figure out only what happened. It's really an attempt, it's two people disputing each other. There's a famous Sefer Beis Halevi that a butcher lost the Din Torah by him. When he lost, he began to scream and yell and destroy this Alevi. To which point the Shamash said to him, after the butcher left, of course, he says to him, I don't understand. Last week you tarpened one of his cows. He lost 1,000 rubles. He didn't say a word. He went home and accepted it humbly. Today he loses a few kopecks and there he is. Look, I'll agitate. He said, you understand. Losing the cows, the other mamako. No problem. The problem is not how much money he lost today. The problem is he lost to his friends. He lost to somebody else. How he was defeated by somebody else is what bothers him. And now, I meant to psychology thing. I think we say that the Torah itself is between two people as subjects. And there's an element of a subject between them. There's everything in Torah really is two people as human beings fighting and arguing. And as such, we have the interval between them. In conclusion, the question of written arguments, the position is in the same mitzvah here. The mitzvah calls for an opinion, not only Eidim, but even the Baalei Dover, that is the people themselves, cannot submit their claims in writing. They have to come and speak in front of Beis Din. Because you expect to participate as human beings and not only to make claims. So I go on and on and on, but my basic point is the following. That even though these are legal issues in a sense, deep down what Halakh is trying to do is to make them into relations between people. In other words, that the drama is not a legal drama necessarily, it's a human drama, and that we expect people to engage as people. I'm reminded, I once had a bris where one of the uncles was a photographer, and all of a sudden gave him a kibbutz to say one of the rachamans, and he was totally confused because he was all of a sudden thrust as a participant from the position of observer, he was thrust into a participant, and it totally confused him because he came as an observer and ended up being a participant. And this is what Halacha wants. It should be participants, it should be relationships between Eidim, between Baalei Dover, between Dayanim, and what's what I think many Halachot illustrate this, that basically the legal relationships should be viewed as eye-down relationships, interpersonal relationships, and not only as technical halach. This is the idea of a shvua, when you take it all, it really means I give you my word, I guarantee subjective, as a human being. It's my word as a person, not, it's not simply an attempt to figure out that you're telling the truth. It's rather, I guarantee, personally, the halacha of Baal and the Shomer, that a Shomer is part of you together because you're acting together, and so on and so forth. And I think it's a very fitting statement to make in honor of tonight's honorees. Of course, my father, I won't puzzle this. I just proved this great lamp. Ashkecha lechova v'zchut minalan. But it's clear to everyone that my father views life in general and halacha specifically as a deep interpersonal interaction, both in Talmud Torah, and of course, I had the great benefit for exactly 50 years because his 50 years of teaching coincides with my 50 years of existence, and he's been teaching me for 50 years, and of course, that's a deep interpersonal relationship, and my father's spoken hundreds of times about the need for a child, for parents to teach with a child, and not only to hire Melamed or to outsource his education, and of course I think his whole interaction with the community at large is based upon an interpersonal relationship, and not only providing Torah knowledge and Torah sophistication, but deep personal relationships with thousands upon thousands of talmidim, and of course, at the second honoree as well, he was the Rav's lawyer, but he was not the Rav's lawyer because of the reliability. He was the Rav's lawyer because of the interpersonal relationships they established. And Baruch Hashem, in our family, it's very third generation. I myself have benefited from the friendship and the interpersonal relationship. And I think our relationship throughout the years has proven that indeed legal relationships can very quickly become interpersonal relationships and deep interpersonal relationships. And I'm really honored to have been here, and to that.